Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and my guest today is Jason Mutford. And Jason is going to talk about the projected outcome of student debt. Now, Jason, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing well this morning.
Great. So you're in your mid-40s. You graduated, I guess I would say 20 years ago, if my estimation is correct. So So you probably are looking at maybe 25, 30 years before you even think about retirement, of course, unless you win the lotto. So do you think, first of all, do you think between now and the time you retire, there's going to be a lot more people with student debt if this is not taken care of soon?
Absolutely. If we don't address what student debt is doing to our economy in a very proactive way, what we're going to start seeing is the results of all the delayed milestones that current graduates are experiencing. They're buying houses a lot later in life, if at all. A lot of them are holding off other milestones just because the student debt is so overwhelming. And with that, the single most important thing that's being delayed is investing in their own retirement. And that's something I know in my personal experience has hit very hard. I had gone to a private institution. It was kind of costly. There were some grants and whatnot, but there were still a lot of loans I had to take out. And I had an extra special whammy thrown onto my situation as I was a full-time graduate student where those loans should have been deferred. And working for the university, they were sending my creditors the wrong address in the wrong city and also the wrong number of credit hours. And while I was that full-time student, those very pricey loans went into default. And unbeknownst to me, because I'm on campus, they can find me to give me a paycheck, they can find me to ask for donations, and there was for some reason a separate database. So with that, I wound up tens of thousands of dollars in debt, more than even the tens of thousands I had initially planned on. And the downstream ramification for that is I really didn't get to start on my retirement until my early 40s. I mean, there were investments, some 403Bs, that kind of thing, and being a teacher, the teacher retirement system, for sure. But as far as actively being able to afford my own contributions, I did not really start. And that 15 to 20 year delay and onset over a lifetime is going to cost me about $1 million in accrued interest. And I can't imagine it delayed my buying a house and being able to afford a car when I needed it. It affected my credit rating. It affected the interest rates on the car loan, the first car I purchased. And certainly with the loans defaulting, the extra whammy on me was I started with a very low credit rating on top of that. And so now I see a lot of this generation coming through, taking on that debt because the pressure to have a college degree, to earn a career, to make the kind of money that would lead to buying a house, maybe starting a small business, something like that. Everyone seems to be ushered into that college track now, and you start off life owing maybe $50,000. and that's $50,000 you're not thinking about investing in your own retirement at age 22. And
right.
if you wait 20 years to do it, that's your $1 million right there. And so I see at the back end of that, when that generation hits retirement, and some of my generation hits retirement, we will not be ready for it. And all of this is also a lost stimulus into just the economy. People are living paycheck to paycheck. It's over 60%. You know, if stock markets take a big hit at some point, and kind of like the housing market did in 2008, it will take a lot longer for people to recover. The emergency funds are not there. The retirement is definitely not there. So downstream, 20 years from now, I would say the overall credit rating of the country is going to be very at risk, because there'll be a bunch of people retirement age not prepared for retirement, and that's going to put just a whole set of pressures on, you know, everything we do economically as a country.
So I believe, like the last presidential election cycle, the student loan debt issue was not addressed. I don't see much in the way of the candidates addressing it this time. And how long these people take it down the road, number one, and number two, why isn't there an absolute outcry for people who are burdened with debt, who know it's unnecessary, that, you know, there's a few that are benefiting from this, but the average person isn't. What's the scenario that you see with nobody addressing it and more people burdened with debt?
Well, I do actually see some people addressing it, but let me speak to that second. If nobody addresses it, if nothing has changed, first there's a wedge between people who can afford to go to college and people who can't. All right, so you're already kind of extra discriminating against poverty class and those who struggled in education. You're just making that divide even further. And then I am seeing some of the candidates talking about dealing with this. The last presidential election, there was some conversation of it coming from the Bernie Sanders camp. But the way he was handled in the media in 2016, that was not the narrative that was played up across the news. This year, in fact, this week, Elizabeth Warren just proposed a major overhaul of this issue. And I looked into some of the analyses of what she was offering. Actually, first, let me outline some of that from my notes here. It was that if your household income was $100,000 or below, public universities should be free for you. And then if your income were between $100,000 and $250,000, then one out of every three of your dollars would be either deductible or canceled. I think the phrasing was canceled. And the idea there is to try to address that gap, to make college more accessible. All right, education is kind of the great equalizer. And so, you know, if you're coming from lower income brackets, but you can have university education, learn something, make yourself marketable, you know, demonstrate that you can commit to yourself for 4 years and come out better. You know, that's going to speak to that income divide. But what's interesting in her plan is that the under 50,000 seems to address 75% of the population. And then the one for three is the next 20% of the population. And when they run the numbers, her plan actually is very good for the middle to upper middle class. They seem to get the most benefit out of it, while some ridiculously small percentage of aid is actually provided to the lowest income brackets. So while it's not helping the 1%, it's also not helping as much, on the bottom tiers as well, the bottom income tiers. And then the other thing is that her whole policy is kind of rested on the same hopeful system that trickle-down economics is based on. She claims it's going to be a great stimulus to the economy, but that presumes that the money does actually get invested in buying houses or setting up small businesses. And there's no guarantee that this generation of folks who would benefit from her plan, if her plan or one like it gets, to become the replacement idea, there's no guarantee that that's how people are going to spend their money. In fact, having come from where we've been with student loans, it seems like millennials are spending more on experiences than they are on actual, investable things like a housing market. I mean, maybe it will stimulate the economy, but just not in the ways that I see them predicting how it's going to stimulate it. So it's more, I think the divide I would say is the money saved not going to college loans there only could help stimulate the economy, not that it necessarily or is likely like to would, it would not necessarily, it just could help the economy.
I'm a baby boomer, so I have a couple of years on you. And when I went to college, there was no such thing as people incurring a tremendous amount of debt to get an education. And today, everybody's incurring debt. Why do you think this happened?
Well, I think several sectors of our economy kind of all of a sudden people realized that these were necessities or going to be necessities, or at least they were marketed as such, and it drove prices up. So like, housing prices, all of a sudden those skyrocketed. It used to be you could save up for your 20% down payment pretty quickly, and then it was maybe 20% of your income to pay off your mortgage. Now a lot of people are paying 50% of their income, and that's just for rent. They are not even able to save up. When it comes to college, same thing. People realized more people are going to college, more industries decided with that they could start demanding that their job applicants had those, or at least it didn't start as a demand, but it was seen as the better candidates had the college degrees, and then that kind of became the default. And colleges and universities said, hey, now that we have so many more people coming and this is what our economy is based on, we can charge more because more people are going to want to come to the universities. And it was just seen as an easy way to really exploit raw capitalism. Capitalism is good, but not if it's overexploited. And I see a lot of these, market sectors as having done that. And so now that's part of the reason we're seeing more and more percentage of our population living paycheck to paycheck is the amount of income coming in has to be sliced up, or I should say each slice that you give to a part of what your budget is a bigger slice. I need an education, that's a bigger slice. I need to, live somewhere, that's a bigger slice. Between your generation and mine, a lot of those markets have seen themselves as, the market that should rightfully earn the money from providing services and or products.
Now, you're also teaching at the university, and you're an adjunct professor. Have you run across a lot of adjuncts, and what is their their feeling for being in on such shaky grounds?
I am fairly new to that position. This is my first semester there. I have not run across too many adjuncts, and as such, most of my conversations are more just kind of onboarding with how do I reserve a classroom, when are grades due, and how are they submitted, that kind of stuff. I haven't had too much social time to really sit down and dig into that. So I can't speak on behalf of other adjunct faculty on that one.
Okay.
I will say this as a citizen, not on behalf of my employer, is that the trend of colleges to do the ratio of fully tenured staff to adjunct has really started moving in a direction that completely counter to the rising cost of going to college. That is, if the price tag is going up that much that quickly over the last decade, two decades, et cetera, I would feel like there could be more tenure track professors who are doing high-end research while also teaching and incorporating students with real-time research. Like, instead, universities are charging more, but they're also providing less because they are, in general, underpaying adjunct faculty when compared to the tenure tracks they had been paying, you know, back in your generation and before.
Now, since there is a proliferation of adjunct professors and a proliferation of student debt, would you say that the big picture is whoever is devising this whole system does not like the middle class and the working person to have an education? They want them to stay on the bottom. And then the richer people who might not be the best qualified to, you know, do something to make this place of, you know,
hello,
make the United States better. Fuck!
Is there a third voice on this call?
No. So what I'm saying is, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought, is that I think that college is purposely out of reach from most people, and it's a deliberate move to keep it that way. What do you think?
My guess is that you have described the worst of what it could possibly be, and I think that might just be a very small portion. I would guess we got ourselves into this situation mostly because just the optimization of companies trying to earn money. So you cut costs, you try to optimize how much work can you get out of one employee. We've gotten a lot better, especially in the computer age, of running big data to suggest where and how to make cuts in employment. We're, you know, leaning towards automizing a bunch of industry. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is just kind of the negligence of not predicting where these policies were going to shift society towards. However, what you described, I'm sure there are some smaller think tanks of elites who say, hey, now that we're here, or now that we're heading here, we could exploit it even further. And so, you know, I think there'll always be somebody looking to actually implement a plan to destroy a middle class, whether financially or educationally. You know, I don't think that that's the majority of people. I don't think there's a lot of people in the 1% or nearby who are just sitting down saying, how can we actively destroy the middle class? There may be conversations that are, wait, how do we make even more money? And then in thinking one-directionally from that question forward and not thinking, well, but how does that really affect the other stakeholders as much, thinking in reverse, you're going to wind up getting more exploitation of middle class just as a natural result.
So ultimately, what do you think the overall effect of everything that's going on long term will have on not only the economy, but with people besides?
Well, I think the long term effect is we definitely need to address this issue because, you know, again, I see more and more people going to retirement, having even less resources available at retirement time. There are reports. I know the can keeps getting kicked down the road for when Social Security is going to run out. I don't think they're ever going to really let it run out because it's a convenient bargaining chip on the table to say, oh, it's running out. I need to use this to strong arm my policy into place to extend Social Security for a few more years. But I really do see. I haven't even said about medical costs. Though that's another market in our overall economy whose costs have gone widely out of control growth wise. And we're going to see a generation suddenly need medical attention as they reach retirement age and beyond, and they're not going to have the retirement. There's not going to be, if we do nothing, there won't be much retirement there. There won't be much, medical support there. And I think those two issues go hand in hand, really. We have to start investing in ourselves and each other much earlier. We have to address the cost of these loans. It would be nice if the money saved on the loans trickles back into the economy. But, Elizabeth Warren's plan, I don't think does enough to incentivize that stimulus or the sustainability or anything. So 20 to 30 years down, I see the United States really struggling as, they kicked the can down the road on this one, and those costs will really start hitting when my generation retires. Baby boomers, I think, were like the last generation that on average could start saving up for retirement easily enough.
Mm-hmm.
My generation, not so much. Millennials, almost not at all.
Okay, so when millennials are ready to retire, do you think that we will continue to be a strong country?
I think we need to continue to have the conversation about student loans, and we need to have the conversation about medical costs, and we need to talk about Social Security and other retirement vehicles. I would like to see plans like Elizabeth Warren's be improved upon instead of just being taken as the solution that will fix it, the issues we have today and the predicted issues we have tomorrow. I sat down as I was taking notes for this conversation, and I asked myself an interesting question. I said, well, okay, what if I were in charge of coming up with this solution? I don't know if my solution is going to be the best one, but I almost immediately hit upon the three things that I'm worried about most are the short-term economic stimulus. We have to stabilize our economy, and we've been doing that since the 2008 housing bubble burst, but we need to actually try to invest in that economy by freeing the money up. All right. Again, that's still kind of trickle downish, but that's the number three reason. Number two reason. What really makes this country amazing and powerful is our consistent ability to drive innovation. So I was thinking about the Industrial Revolution in the 1880s, and we really took a good boom in creating that kind of generation. And then about 1900, 1910, we start seeing assembly lines and factories. And thankfully, we also started seeing, you know, some development of unions for workers' rights on that one. During the wartime effort in the 1940s, suddenly we have more innovation. During the 1960s, and even a little bit before that, we saw the space race. That led to incredible innovations. In the 1990s, we've seen the internet. Our country thrives on innovation. And education is the key to get us a sustainable amount of workers who can handle not just doing the jobs that we think of today, but are actually coming up with the jobs of tomorrow. And then, on top of that, was the thing I was saying before. My number one reason for why I would propose some different changes from, like, Elizabeth Warren's policy is to diffuse that retirement bubble. That 15 to 30 years out, we need all the other things to be in place to not have a sudden collapse, economically speaking. And so I agree with the plans, like, oh, we need to cap the costs at public universities and make them potentially free to just about everyone, or maybe even everyone. What I would like to see universities do is when you apply, most people are taking 4 years, and now with additional programs and internships and, you know, maybe possibly a gap year in the middle, when you apply to college, you should know the price tag, not for that year, but for 5 years. This way you can plan accordingly. Oh, I'm going to owe this at the end. It's not going to be a renegotiation. So a lot of mistakes made going into college, people have grants that work for year one, and then they're surprised to find out they needed to do something to make sure that they also had grants for years two, three, four, that it wasn't automatic or it wasn't going to extend the entire length. So, you know, if we are going to make student loans of any kind, you need to know all the terms. It can't be just, well, I did year one, and now I'm in debt, and I don't have my degree yet, but now I have to renegotiate terms. One of the potentially underused resources, the Departments of Labor, both federally and on the state levels, they do massive data collection on industry. What are the industry needs? Like New York, for example, there's regular unemployment insurance, but there's also the 599 plan. And that's a plan where instead of having to look for work, if you qualify, you can actually go back to college and they will pay for it. But the catch with the 599 program is that your set of educational experiences and skills need to be in an industry that, if given just a small push for additional education, would make you suddenly much more marketable than where you are today. And so that we have those data sets, and we're constantly updating them, and I think that needs to be part of this program too. It's nice to say universities will be free, but are we actually steering people towards the needs of the country? You know, are we going to have the kind of engineering jobs filled by people who are benefiting from the free education? Are we going to have the kind of, you know, just pick an industry and see, do we need more of that kind of worker, or should we shift people away from degrees that they will struggle to find work in? And so that needs to be part of the plan too. And I haven't heard any part of that, whether it's Liz Warren's plan or there's another candidate running, entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who recommends universal based income, but he also is suggesting a lot of the same things. But neither of them are really talking about what are the forecasted needs. Not only should we send people to college if they want to go, but steer them towards things that actually really do make them marketable. And then some other things that I would look at is if the college costs were not completely covered, or if somebody went to a private university, to make the banking industry less predatory. So we can't just erase the costs and then say, well, then nobody's going to get a loan. No, there's still going to be people going to private universities that need loans who are going to accrue massive debt. And so perhaps what I would like to see is, during the time that you're still in your 4 or 5 year window, your loan is at 0%. And even for the first year after you graduate, after one full year, it goes up to 1%. After the second year, it goes up to 2%. This way, yes, you're paying your loan back, and you can pay it back over a significant period of time, but we're not seeing the 11% average interest rate on these loans. I mean, that's an incredibly high percentage to be asking from people who are starting their jobs at entry level. And meanwhile, that's 11% on maybe the second most expensive thing they ever buy in a lifetime, other than like a house. And I'm not seeing any real concrete numbers on capping those percentages. So that's what I came up with as a concept. It's to not stop where these new couple of proposals are being loosely talked about, but to actually really focus in on what do we want our university policies to be. We should be sending more people to college. Absolutely. And not that everyone needs to go to college, but we should send more people to college. College degrees should be functional, more functional on average. I know a great message is do what you love, but that doesn't necessarily sustain the economy. There needs to be more conversation on figuring out how to love what you do for a living, how to feel like you're an important person helping the overall society.
Right.
You know, nobody grows up. I know somebody who works in the healthcare industry, and that person, if you ask them, hey, when you grow up from high school, what do you want to become? In no way would that person have said, I would like to be a claims agent. But I hear that person talk so highly about the job they do. They get to look at whether or not payments are being sent out correctly. And they're able to actually discuss policy implementations when things are changed. There's puzzles to solve. Does this case apply? Does this case not apply? And then even when like I said, that person never in their life dreamed that would be an exciting amount of work. But then the cognitive stimulus of you have to think about what you're doing for a living on a daily basis, and you really are affecting human lives in your decisions. And that person finds their work highly rewarding now. So doing what you love is a narrow search. We should all strive for doing what we love, but we shouldn't put such blinders on that. If you don't do exactly what you think you're going to love doing, then suddenly you're a failure. Because that's not true at all. Actually, a surprising stat that speaks to that is, I believe it's somewhere around 60% of people who currently hold a college degree are not working in a field or a job that directly uses their college degree. We're incurring all this debt when 3 out of 5 people are really just using their college degree to demonstrate an ability to be trained, an ability to commit to that training. And again, that's the second most expensive thing most people are buying in their lifetime. 60% of them are not directly using it.
So, Jason, you brought up a number of important issues, and I want to invite people listening to this to, talk about what you've said and share their thoughts So are you listening to Jason Mumford? And if you like what Jason has said, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, All Exits Closed. And Jason, I hope maybe you will come on again to continue the conversation, and everybody out there listening who might want to join the conversation. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Great. So thanks, and we'll talk again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a wonderful day.